Rock of Israel, Father of all men, we are stirred by the sacred memories of thy wondrous help unto our fathers in days of old.
Young, ultra-conservative Republicans. At a meeting of the New Jersey chapter of this group in January of 1966, new words were sung to the old doggerel Jingle Bells. Riding through the Reich in a Mercedes-Benz, shooting down the kikes, making lots of friends. Rat-a-tat-tat-tat, mow the bastards down. Oh, what fun it is to have the Nazis back in town. Now, Jews, understandably, were not impressed by the official explanation. This was just lighthearted fun. '66 was not a year at whose end we could say that we had come 365 days closer to the burying of anti-Semitism. Oh, what fun it is to have the Nazis back in town, or was it? When the Nazis came back to Chicago town, sought to fish in the backwash of Martin Luther King's open housing crusade, the troubled, the frightened, and the ignorant. Do you remember those scenes of on the television set of an excited large rally in a Chicago park, where Polish Americans and German Americans are handing up to uniformed stormtroopers dollar bills to finance their racial crusade as their banners proclaimed to keep America pure, Jews, get out. '66 saw an election which was held largely without overt anti-Semitic incident. A record number of 17 congressmen, Jewish congressmen, were elected to the House of Representatives. But we didn't seem to be able to shake ourselves loose of the wellsprings of hate. Somehow the habits of hate came in again and showed themselves again and again in the white backlash. And though it was black power and not Jew power, which was the evocative symbol for the disturbed, the unwashed, the frenzied, nevertheless, they seemed to believe that communist, atheist, Jew were synonymous labels, and that there was somehow a basic Jewish element to this conspiracy to undermine and to integrate their communities, destroy and to change their way of life. During 1966, there was that well-publicized meeting of civil rights leaders with the school board of Mount Vernon, New York, at which a disturbed and angry Negro leader shouted, "Hitler made a mistake when he didn't kill more of you." During 1966, there were still the unwritten but very specific bars to employment in the executive suites of many large banking, iron and steel, automobile, hard goods corporations. And there were still the unwritten membership clauses in many of our downtown clubs, like our union club. No Jews may be admitted to membership. Even though a great deal of corporate business and of communal business is transacted at these tables, eased by the luxuriant surroundings and by drink. 1966 was a year of continuing, habitual anti-Semitism. And though most of us prefer to go about our business, taking advantage of those many and magnificent opportunities which American life did offer, putting down these acts as the acts of the lunatic fringe or the paranoid, or as bad habits which a generation would learn to outgrow. Nevertheless, some of us with historical memories remembered France in the 1870s and Germany in the 1920s. The fact that when the bloom is brushed off the economic rose, that when a nation becomes internationally frustrated, disturbed and by its own leadership, it often finds a scapegoat, turns against the Jew. It has happened before. And many of us were worried that the war in Vietnam, the summer riots, the economic tensions and inflations might yet in a significant way affect the context of American Jewish life. Now, there were some partially aware of this who answered, who responded to this awareness by pulling in their liberal sails. Many had been involved in the Civil Rights Crusade, and during 1966, many Jews disembarked from that crusade. When many rabbis and religious institutions spoke out quite bluntly about our administration's policies in Vietnam, our defense agencies, especially the B'nai B'rith, were quick to unleash the duplicating machines and to flood the public press with the obvious statement that these men spoke only their convictions and they did not speak the united opinion of the American Jewish community. For many, fearless citizenship is a luxury we can afford only in settled and happy times. When the clouds darken, when the skies become overcast, apparently the first question many Jews ask is, Ma yomru hagoyim? What will the majority say? Even before we raise the question, is it right? Is it necessary? Is it good for mankind? Israelis who visit America often remark that American Jews tell them again and again and again, we are different. America is different. We are so firmly rooted, so established, so much a part of the American way of life that it can't happen here. This community cannot be shipwrecked on the political and economic shoals. We are secure. But are we that secure? When in September the President of the United States summoned the commander of the Jewish war veterans to his office and seemed to indicate to him that administrative support for Israel was somehow contingent on rising American Jewish support for our policies in Vietnam, our bureaucrats rushed to the White House, insisted that the President had not said what he had indeed said, and issued pious proofs and credentials of citizenship. We were confident, but not that supremely confident. We did not believe ourselves in galut, in exile, but we were not yet that firmly rooted. During 1966, the American Jewish community continued the wonderful work of generosity, the philanthropy, which has characterized it for lo these many years. The American Jewish community gave, during the last 12 months, almost $600 million to educational, welfare, medical, and relief agencies. We sent almost $63 million to Israel through the United Jewish Appeal. We sent another $25 million to the educational enterprise of Israel. Almost $100 million worth of Israeli bonds were sold during the past year. and $250 million were invested in welfare services and welfare plants within our local communities. American Jewry could be proud of the contribution it had made to the wholesomeness and the saneness of our American way of life. And our institutions were often pathfinders and pace setters in terms of the quality and the level and the ingenuity of service being offered. Still, we had to recognize during 1966 the implications of a couplet written 700 years ago by the Spanish Jewish poet Moses Ibn Ezra. The body of man, he wrote, the body of man is light when the soul is therein. But when the soul departs, it falls heavily to the ground. Our Jewish communities, our federations, could no longer count automatically on the loyalty and on the interest of a new generation. The American Jewish community is a voluntary community. You must willingly accept your identity and your place in it. And there were many who were disinclined so to do. It was not that the activities, the philanthropies, the welfare of the engaged in by our communities was ticked off as unnecessary or unwelcome, but rather our young people were asking, why must a hospital be a Jewish hospital? Why must basketball and baseball and boxing be Jewish sports? Why must we identify and channel our citizenship through a Jewish focus? Faith is the soul of the American Jewish community. Learning, awareness, understanding, happy and meaningful identification. And it was becoming increasingly evident that the soil was weak, if not lacking. The facts are well known. Though 3/4 of the American Jewish community contribute in one way or another to our welfare enterprise, less than 1/2 of the American Jewish community has ever been identified with a synagogue, and of that 1/2, 1/2 again is identified only during the years of elementary religious education for their children up to the moment of the puberty rite of the bar mitzvah. Less than 1 Jewish adult in 5 replenishes and recharges his spiritual batteries even once a month by attendance at the synagogue. The American Jewish community was training its young people for a ritual, a rite, at the age of 13, was leaving them with a purely ritualistic and religious education, which was utterly inadequate to the challenges and the responsibilities of modern life. And understandingly, the young people confronting the challenges and the responsibilities of adult life were finding that faith crumbling underneath them. And we're leaving it and looking for identity and philosophy and commitment elsewhere. The challenge of identification is the challenge which faces the American Jewish community. We have refined and financed our social welfare enterprise to the nth degree. Our educational enterprise is a horse and buggy enterprise. It's still carried on, largely it was carried on within the first decade of the immigration of Jews to the United States. It is still largely irrelevant to the life of the average young Jew today. It is inadequately staffed, inadequately financed, and the results are visible for all to see. We must find a way to educate our young people through their high school years. Less than 1 Jewish child in 75 receives a single hour of instruction beyond the age of 15. Now, Hillels on some college campuses have been able to create an active and electric Jewish ethos. But on other campuses, Hillel is nothing more than a kosher cafeteria and a fraternity and a sorority for those who are not otherwise invited into the social life. Be that as it may, Hillel operates at only 1 in 4 of the major campuses in the United States. And because of the pressures and difficulties of college admission, more and more of our young people are scattering about the United States. More and more are being placed during these formative years, these challenging years, these marrying years in areas which are utterly devoid of any Jewish commitment. We demand at least some expertise of our Jewish leadership, some expertise in social welfare, some expertise in organizational management, some knowledge of fundraising. We have not demanded of them, and we do not demand of them now, awareness, knowledge, understanding of our history, of our traditions, of our literature, and of our way of life. And their decisions, their priorities reflect very often this innocence and this lack of understanding. What is needed is a new sculpturing of the priorities of American Jewish life. We must find a way to find the money and the manpower and the skills to devise an intelligent educational institution, synagogues and schools and academies and colleges and forums, camps, to which our young people can go, to which our young adults can be enticed, which will bring the knowledge, the learning, the maturity, the wisdom of the tradition to bear on our way of life. The challenges are mountainous. There has been some improvement in the number of chairs of Jewish studies and courses of Jewish studies which are offered in the major universities. There are 92 colleges in the United States offering such courses today. 92 out of 1,100. Only a beginning has been made. And unless the American Jewish community brings itself into line and recognizes that the soul is lacking, is not being nourished, is not being strengthened, unless it begins to plunge ahead, full draft, full steam, into the responsibilities of education, spiritual commitment, we are in danger of having a top-heavy enterprise, a body without a soul, a community without citizens, which will in the end topple of its own weight. 1966 was a year in which the American Jewish community recognized and hopefully began to grapple with the problem of religious identification, survival in the 20th century, spiritual survival. Around the world, many of the same problems troubled our Jewish communities. But there was also the basic problem, the visceral problem, the jugular problem of survival itself. Far too many could still sigh the sigh of Ibn Ezra, whom I quoted earlier. How long, he wrote, how long must my feet at fate's behest tread the sad road of exile? There are almost 500,000 Jews in the Argentine. During 1966, the democratic government of the Argentine was overthrown and supplanted by an ultra-nationalist military junta. The Jews were worried. Till now, the military junta of General Onganya has behaved itself quite correctly towards the Jewish community, but it has done nothing to restrict the depredations, the activity, the daubing of swastikas, the bruising of young Jewish boys and girls out for a picnic or at the beach, which is undertaken quite routinely by the Tacuara and other groups of young, ultramontane, high church toughs who have their own vision of what Argentina ought to be. The Argentine today contains the largest group of ex-Nazis in the world. This was the country to which they fled after the fall of Hitler. And these people are all too eager to complete the work which Allied victory denied them. The world saw during 1966 the desecration of cemeteries at Dachau, at Auschwitz, Bergen-Belsen, the concentration camps. It saw the arsoning of synagogues in London and in Frankfurt. It saw the daubing of swastikas on Jewish stores and on synagogues in half a dozen towns in Germany. It saw enough to know that our life remains as Jewish life has for so long been, a life of faith, a life of danger, a life not as secure as we might wish it to be. There were 120,000 Jews of the Union of South Africa. Technically, legally, they were free, but they were caught in the vice, the racial vice of apartheid, the demands of the majority black, the commands, the dictatorship of the minority white. And though the Jewish community was free, there was an unwritten law within that community that anyone who had official position was not to speak out against apartheid. If a rabbi were to stand in the Union of South Africa in his pulpit and preach Judaism on the issue of race, he would receive very quickly a one-way ticket to London or to New York. And three rabbis did receive their tickets during 1966. But it was the Jewry of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republic, Russian Jewry, Soviet Jewry, which preoccupied our attention during 1966, largely because of the publicity activities of the Committee to Combat Soviet Anti-Semitism. The background of the Russian nuisance attack on these Jews is well known. In 1959, the Russian government began to prohibit the baking of matzahs for the Passover, to prohibit the publication of Yiddish books, to prohibit the printing of new siddurim, new prayer books, and new luach, new diaries with the dates of the Jewish holidays in them. Tens upon tens of the smaller Jewish synagogues were closed down. Anti-Semitic caricatures began to appear in the Soviet press, especially in the press of the Ukraine. An inordinate number of Jews were caught and convicted and sentenced to death in the economic trials of those years. Now, this anti-Semitic attack was a politically maneuvered and politically inspired attack by the Soviet government, even though it drew its poison, its motive power, from the ancient wells of racial hate, of Jewish hate within Russia. The Soviet Union was determined to win over the allegiance, the friendship of the Arab Near East. It is a basic plank of Soviet foreign policy. It will replace the West as a dominant economic factor in that part of the world. To control the Near East is to control oil, which Russia sorely needs. It is to control an opening to the sea and to the Indian Ocean, which she has for long needed. And so, in a quite Machiavellian fashion, the Soviet Union organized this attack on Jewish security, placed the Jewish community under restraint, and boasted of its activity throughout the Arab world. In the last 2 years, during 1964 and 1965, many of these restrictions were somewhat relaxed. Four Yiddish books were allowed to be published in the last 24 months. A Yiddish monthly published by a second-rate Jew-hating but Jewish Yiddish-writing poet, Vergelis, the Soviet homeland, Sovjetische Heimland, was published during this time. We were allowed again to bake matzahs in the major Soviet cities. Why the relief? No one quite knows. But the relief has not been a wholehearted one. There are still no new prayer books. There are still no new diaries. The restrictions which closed the one yeshiva in all of Russia, the rabbinic college in Moscow, are still in effect. Russia has no interest in the well-being of her Jewish community except to restrain the level of criticism from the West and at the same time maintain the interest and the allegiance and the support of the Arab world. During 1964 and 65 and 66, the Soviet Union sent to General Nasser $2 billion worth of sophisticated military weaponry and another $2 billion worth of development aid and foodstuffs. During 1966, the Soviet Union sent to Syria, to General Yadid, $1 billion worth of military weapons and 1,000 military advisors to show the Syrian army how to use these weapons. It was the Russian pronouncement of May of 1966 which gave a carte blanche, complete support to Syria's actions against Israel, which permitted Syria to encourage the year-long El Fateh commando attacks, the guerrilla raids, the dynamiting, which disturbed the Israeli border during the entire year of 1966. And as the year closes, it is the Soviet determination to overthrow the pro-Western Hashemite Kingdom of the Jordan, which has led to the border incidents between Syria and Jordan of the last several weeks, which has led to the rearming of the Palestinian Arabs by Syria within the last several months, and which has led to the demand from Cairo and from Sukheiri, the head of the Palestine Liberation Organization, for the assassination of King Hussein. The Soviet Union has determined and clear goals in the Near East. These goals are to throw out the West, which has drawn off the oil and the richness of this area for 100 years, and to replace the West as the dominant power. And to a very large measure, it can be said that as 1966 closes, it is Soviet foreign policy which will determine whether there will be war or whether there will be peace in the Middle East. Only the Soviets know whether they will restrain the Syrians, whether they will restrain the Egyptians, whether they will restrain the Palestine Liberation Organization or unleash them, whether they are determined to open a second front, to embarrass the United States on a second front, to limit our war effort in Vietnam, or whether they want a detente with the West and are unwilling to allow policy in that part of the world to rise beyond the fever pitch into open war. In January of 1966, when he formed his new cabinet, Prime Minister Levi Eshkol appealed to, in a public message to the Soviet Union for better relationships with the Soviet. The answer was silence. The answer was the cancellation of a cultural exchange which had been arranged between Israel and the Soviet Union. The answer was the expulsion of an Israeli diplomat from the Israel embassy in Moscow. Later in January of 1966, Foreign Minister Abba Ibn of Israel appealed to Moscow to join a four-power, France, England, the United States, and Russian commitment to guarantee the borders of the Near East, to impose an arms embargo across the entire Near East, and to guarantee the existing borders. The Soviet response was silence, except that she signed with General Yadid, the Syrian, a policy statement in Moscow encouraging Syria to undertake the recapture of legitimate Arab positions throughout the Middle East, encouraging him to unleash the El Fateh, the guerrillas, against Israel. 60 raids, 60 murderous raids were carried out by the El Fateh and other guerrilla groups between that Moscow declaration of early March and the first Israeli retaliation in early August. 25 Israelis died. Hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of property were affected. The Soviet Union saw to it that when Israel appealed to the United Nations for the condemnation of these attacks, for some type of international control of its borders, that nothing was done to censure Syria, that no controls were imposed. Finally, after the Israelis retaliated against Syria in early August, 40 more attacks were launched by these guerrillas. This resulted, as you know, in the retaliation against the El Samu village in Jordan, one of the jumping-off places where the guerrillas massed of an evening before they crossed single file the desert, the wilderness, into Israel. Now Israel had done an unconscionable thing. It had not only protected the life and limb of its own citizens, but it had stamped on the toes of some American interests in the Middle East. America has been desperately trying to retrieve its position in that part of the world by building up two of the most feudal, most caste-ridden, most archaic governments on the face of the earth. The slave-owning government of Saudi Arabia and the government of the Jordan. Why had Israel attacked the Jordan? For months, Israel had pleaded with the United States. Your government, Israel had told Washington, underwrites the entire military budget of Jordan. Your government underwrites 70% of the cost of the Arab refugees who live in Jordan. Your government has given planes and tanks and missiles to the Jordanian government. Why don't you very simply demand of Hussein that he seal the border? It's our longest border. We can defend ourselves against Syria and against Egypt. At least seal this border, from which 70 of the 90 raids against our own nation have been launched. America promised, and there was an action. America counseled Israel to be patient, and Israel was patient. But how long? How long would America be patient if every night boats crossed Lake Erie and bombs were thrown from Canada against the city of Cleveland? How long would it be before we began to retaliate? Does not a government have the responsibility of protecting the life and limb of its own citizenship? But Israel retaliated against Jordan, and America's interests in Jordan, and Israel's retaliation threatened the shaky political status quo. The great powers of the world, each for their own reason, happily and quite morally drew themselves up like old dowagers and censured Israel for this unwarranted protection of life and of limb. It would have been far wiser, far more mature of our government, had we listened to Israel, to what Israel was saying, to what it said even with the raid. For what was the raid? Not simply the bombing of a village which had been a guerrilla nest, but an appeal to the West, an appeal for help, an appeal for the sealing of a border. And America's response? An urgent shipment of planes and tanks to the Jordan. No sealing of the border, but more weapons into this part of the world which needs not weapons, but hospitals and roads and irrigation ditches and irrigation pipes and schools and teachers. All the things which will prevent famine, misery, and want. But the great powers are determined to stuff the Near East with arms. And 1966 has been a year of an aggravated, accelerated arms race in which Israel perforce has had to maintain her defensive position. 1966 was not an easy year for the state of Israel. It was, as you know, a year of some economic difficulty. Israel had been rather lax in permitting a great number of consumer goods to be to be built, to be sold. Excuse me. To be built, to be sold. It is not from New Year's. I was in bed at 11 o'clock last night. Israel permitted an overabundance of consumer goods to be published, to be purchased during the last several years. The result was that there was inflation, wages rose, productivity did not rise apace, Israel goods were increasingly non-competitive in the international market. There was a trade imbalance of about $500 million, an excessive imbalance for a small nation. During the year, Israel began what the government calls a program of quasi-austerity. Higher taxes, restricted consumer production, a search for new industries which can sell goods to the world, a program to gain some kind of relationship with the common market. Productivity is to be brought in line with wages, and it is hoped that within a year or two, the Israeli economy will again be moving full speed ahead. Israel during 1966 suffered from an educational crisis, brought on largely by an inability to continue the education of the large majority of her people beyond the high school years. 64 new high schools are required in Israel. The college population will have to be doubled within a decade. These problems faced Israel, and she was confident that given time, she would be able to deal with them. But the overriding question, the overriding issue, was the question of peace. Peace cannot be made or established unilaterally. Peace in the Near East will have to come when it is, in a sense, imposed by the larger powers without. The Near East, as 1966 ends, is closer to war than it has been for many a year. But war is not inevitable. The great powers may still recognize that it is to their mutual advantage to dampen the fires, to control the pressures, to impose a limitation of arms upon all the parties involved. Israel does not want the arms race. Israel wants an end to the arms race, an opportunity to divert its wealth into constructive channels. Israel does not want to have to man and patrol its borders every day, every hour of every day of the year. Israel wants its manpower for building and for schooling to tool up its plant, to take its place among the family of nations. But when one's enemy is determined to exterminate, to trample on, to destroy, then one must protect, even as Israel has protected its interests, lo, these 19 years. It is to the advantage of our government and of the Soviet Union in the long run to limit the arms race, to impose peace in the Middle East. But as the year ends, as one speaks the truth, one must say simply that neither of the great powers seems willing or interested at the moment in such a program. We seem determined to pour all the excess of our military production to this wasteland, into these feudal kingdoms, into these revolutionary kingdoms. Guns which can have no useful purpose, planes which could have no peaceful function, missiles which will not launch scientific satellites. We seem determined to find an area in which we can muscle each other about a bit, test our weapons, hopefully keeping the fighting somewhat away from our own shores. Lozu Haderech. Morally and politically, it is a self-defeating, foolish, futile way. And one would pray as 1966 ends that the major governments of the world would recognize the folly and the immorality of their position. As 1966 ends, I would read to you the close of another of the poems of Ibn Ezra. Ochil ma'at la'el, ve'ed ma'at sor, kro lidkor asir parud, lifkach koach. The hope be long deferred, though heart be faint. On God I wait. On God I wait, unto whose mercy there is no restraint, and whose decree can break the shackles and unbar the gate, and set the prisoner of exile free. 1966 was a year not unlike many, many, many years in our Jewish tradition. It was a year of unsettling fact. It was a year in which Jewish survival rested where ultimately Jewish survival has always rested, on our own shoulders. We are not here because we counted on the goodwill of the world. We are here because Jews believed and Jews affirmed and Jews were steadfast and Jews looked to their own interests. And the responsibility is here. And we undertake that responsibility firm in our faith that God has ordained for us an eternal role as his messenger to the world, of truth, of Torah, of justice, and righteousness and peace. Ochi la'el, I wait for the Lord, and I keep my powder dry. Amen.